I mean, 1031 has been around for 100 years. It's survived tax reform for a reason. It's powerful. I mean, it's a driver. It's the greatest stimulator of economic growth existing in the tax code. This is something you don't touch. This has been critical to the farm real estate economy for years.
Ladies and gentlemen, farmers, ranchers, and distinguished guests, thank you for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast, where we discuss the latest ideas, methods, trends, and techniques available to help your farm achieve higher levels of farm profitability. The Farm for Profit podcast is co-hosted by Tanner Winterhoff, the Iowa Bankerman, and David Whitaker, the Iowa Land Guy, where in tandem, they will share their ideas and advice from industry experts. Thank you again for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast. Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long. And now, here's Tanner and David.
And listeners, welcome back to another Farm for Profit episode. This is Tanner Winterhoff.
And this is David Whitaker.
Thank you again so very, very much for liking and rating and reviewing, and most importantly, sharing with your family and your friends how much you enjoy our content, how much you enjoy listening and what you're learning from us. And we greatly appreciate that, Dave.
You bet. And Tanner, today we're talking with FlyingEgg.com, and I'm super excited for this conversation because you know me, I like drones. I've been flying them for a while, and that's what they specialize in. So who are we talking with?
Yep, we've got Randy Oberle. So he's a farmer and a dealer for this. Randy's from East Central Illinois and has a lot of experience on the high-tech end of the farming operation, not just drones, but that's what we're here to talk about today. Welcome to the phone call.
Thanks for having me.
Well, hey, Randy, where are you located and how are you connected with Ag, just real quick?
Yeah, so I'm from the Gibson City, Illinois area. We're north of Champaign, east of Bloomington. So I'm a farmer. We run about 2,200 acres. I'm also a precision planting dealer and for a dealer for 360, you know, Martin Industries, Yetter.
Great. And one of the things that you do is fly drones, or you have a company called Flying Egg, flyingegg.com. And I was looking at it. I know I've heard of it before. Tell us a little bit about what is flyingegg.com.
Sure. So Flying Egg got established back in, I believe it was 2014. And, you know, the drone industry was very, very new and fresh at that point in time. There was a lot of different companies coming on board, tons of different sensors and cameras and whatnot. And, you know, a big part of that, there was a lot of custom built stuff at that point in time. And I started looking into some, and some of the other guys that I knew were looking into some of this stuff. And we realized really fast that, you know, there wasn't a reason to spend a lot of money on this. And then it being almost everything being custom meant in a short period of time, it wasn't worth anything because the industry was changing so fast.
That's my recollection of, you know, being on top of technology through Farm for Profit. It was fun to kind of follow this process as it went. And I felt like there was a lot of changes made very quickly in the world of drones. So How would you gauge from where we've come to where we're at right now, Randy, in the world of drones tied to agriculture?
Sure. You know, a big part of where we started, you know, because I mean, back then, I mean, there still is to some extent, but, you know, there was big wings, you know, that you would use a launcher to get in the air. There was a lot of quadcopters, some, you know, and even some hexacopters and octocopters, and, you know, just depending on what they were doing. And there's every level of sensor under the sun, you know, from very basic, simple little, hard mounted cameras to, you know, some of the higher end stuff. But, you know, I mean, drones have been around for a couple of years before even a gimbal was, you know, realistically available to help stabilize cameras and things like that.
Well, that's interesting. I think the coolest part, Randy, about Flying Egg that I like is kind of the same way we approach our guests on this podcast, is you all have a tie to agriculture. Could you introduce our listeners to maybe the partners in the company with you?
Yeah. So Corey lives up in northern Indiana. He's a large pork producer, and then they have they raise all their own corn to feed the hogs and whatnot as well. They also recently developed a like a farm to fork, being able to buy pork direct through a local processor there. Part of it was necessity as the due to the COVID and whatnot with pork plants shutting down. But also part of it was just the desire to reach out and interact with customers better. Martin is out in the Bakersfield, California area. He's big grower with all different kinds of nuts and avocados and just all that kind of stuff that goes out there in the San Joaquin Valley. And that's just a very interesting dynamic of how things are grown out there as well. We'd all kind of had experience with drones to some level. Like I said, this was, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And kind of how we got started was we'd had enough customers and friends and whatnot coming to us going, all right, you've been playing with this for a while. What do you recommend? Because anybody from the outside could see that there was just a lot of different options.
And there is a lot of moving parts to that. And I see, I know I've looked at your website, flyingegg.com. You guys have kits that are already ready for farmers. So to our listeners that are looking, you have kits that are available from the one of the newest out there, the DJI Mini 2. There's an Ag Pro kit and there's a Phantom 4 kit. There's thermal kits if you want to do thermal layering on that. Help our listeners understand, why do they go through you? Why buy the kit? Or just why not just go to DJI direct?
Yeah, we kind of started creating these kits from the beginning because we'd had enough other people coming to us going, okay, so what drone do you recommend? All right. So if I get that, well, what else am I going to need? Well, you're going to want a better case. You're going to want more batteries and, this, that, and the other. And so, we had kind of got together and said, we could make kits out of this, and agriculture has always been our focus. From the beginning was we're trying to help farmers get into this realm. Cause we could tell, or we knew the value of being able to get up over the top of your crop and be able to help assist in scouting. And so we started making kits and basically when the kit shows up on your doorstep, you need to charge the batteries and the controller and attach your tablet or your phone to it and you're ready to go fly.
Well, that seems pretty easy.
That's good.
Right.
So what all's included in the kit to our farmers? You're given batteries, probably the controller, extra blades. Of course, the camera is connected to most of the drones now, and then probably the chargers. And do you get a case with it?
Yeah. So we put all of our kits in Go Professional cases, which is a good hard-sided weatherproof kit. You get caught out in the rain or throw it in the back of your pickup or whatever, everything's protected. It's all custom cut foam that holds everything in there. Kits all have 3 or 4 batteries in them, extra props. Obviously the drone, the cameras are all attached to the drones. And so the drone's in there, the controller's in there, the harnesses that any cords that you might need. It should be everything that you need to go fly. Like I said, short of your phone or tablet.
Okay, so if I'm a farmer that has never flown one before, obviously you make it seem like it's pretty easy to get it out of the kit, put it in the air, and put it to work. But if I've never thought about this before, what are the common uses that a farmer, because that's a majority of our listeners, are actively farming in agriculture, what are common uses for a drone in a farming operation?
Yeah, so obviously there's always the fun pictures and videos and stuff that help. I mean, we work long hours, during, spring and fall, and it just helps bring some fun to that portion and be able to look back on things. But the part that really, makes us money, if you will, is the ability to get out and get up over the top of the crop and assist in scouting. It's, we all know what it's like to go walk a field of corn in July when the corn's 6 feet tall, and, you know, and we're out just kind of walking around to see what we can see. But we also realize that we could be three rows away from a problem area and never see it. Whereas you get up over the top of it, and now I'm looking for the different colors of the field. And you get up over the top and it's like, well, I know what that area is over there. You know, there's a water course or whatever, but what's this area showing up right here? And we may not be able to diagnose it from the air. We possibly can by going lower and getting close and whatnot. But if we at least know where the problem area is, we know where to go walk to and go check it out.
Well, that's great. And for you listeners out there that are thinking, I can't fly a drone, having flown a drone now for years myself, it's not that hard. They literally, you put it on auto position with all the GPS stuff. It's fantastic. You don't need to be, you're not going to drop out of the air and drop your $1,500 or $2,000 investment. So one other thing, you talked about doing crops and going out there seeing on top of them. One way that I've done that and seen other companies do that in the past is drone deploy. Tell us about drone deploy. What is that?
Yeah, so drone deploy is a company that's based out in San Francisco, California. They're big in the construction industry for being able to map job sites and calculate dirt movement and, you know, site prep and whatnot very quickly. But they're also fairly well known in the ag industry as well, in that they can do automated flight and photo stitching. And so from a, you know, usage standpoint, it's very simple. You use their app rather than the DJI app when you fly. It opens on a Google Earth image. You click around the area you want to fly. It sets up a flight plan, and you literally push up one button and the drone starts up, takes off, goes up and flies that pattern. It streams the video back to your device and stitches it right there in front of you, so you can see a low resolution image of what it's flying as it's going back and forth. And then you can upload the images to their server and they will stitch it all together and return you a high resolution image, you know, in a matter of a few hours.
So that I think is opening a can of worms, David. We might have to do a full show sometime on drone technology and the uses of drones. I mean, I'm sitting here learning more about it. Obviously, Dave, you've got a little bit more experience than I do, but Randy, you're shedding a lot of light on things. But I want to get back to the basics of why we're talking to you today. It's because we learned about Flying Ag and flyingag.com for your kits. And, mm-hmm. and one of those things that in our pre-conversation you were mentioning sets you apart from others is the service that you provide. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
You know, so I mean, we're selling the same drones that you can go buy on Amazon and Best Buy, whatever. You know, they're all DJI drones. They sell, I don't know, 80% of the drones worldwide. You know, we go through the different versions of drones and whatnot, and, you know, and each one keeps getting better. But it's from the service aspect, you know, if you got a problem, I can guarantee you that nobody at Best Buy knows how to hardly fly a drone, let alone how to utilize it in ag. You know, yeah, DJI has a call center that you can call in. I like to say they're a front for their service department, so they always want you to send it in to get checked out. Whereas if you call Flying Ag, that number rings to me, I have personal experience, you know, in the ag industry, of how we're using them, what we're doing with them. And if something happened, you know, that you did hit something, you know, we'll help facilitate getting that repaired.
Perfect. Well, I tell you what, Randy, give me your contact info and how people contact you and your website to get in touch with you if they're thinking of getting a drone.
Yeah, so you can go to flyingag.com. It's a full e-commerce site. All of our kits are on there. And you can go through and check out. The number to call is on the website. Yeah, go to flyingag.com. That's FLYINGAG.com. Thank you.
And if you listeners want to reach out to Randy, it looks like it's 260-888-3350. Again, that's 260-888-3350. And there's something fun if you're listening today, right?
Yep. So I'm going to throw all that information in the show notes. But listeners, David and I and Corey are always working for you. And the fun part about these relationships that we're building is it's fun to have companies on the cutting edge on our episodes. So what we talked Flying Ag into is being able to give you an extra battery when you order a drone. When you order one of their Mavic drones, they'll throw in an extra value of that battery. You got to use the Farm for Profit code. If you use that code, Farm for Profit, to get that free battery, that code is not good forever. So if you pick up this podcast after February 1st, I'm sorry, you are too late. But when we learn about these companies, I think we're going to keep doing this for you. When we're able to feature the new technology and exciting things in your ears, we're going to try and make a little extra incentive for you guys to maybe make an investment in yourself and in the farm. And the cool part about the minis is it's not a large barrier of entry for a cost. Much easier to get into a drone now, Randy, than it was in the past, correct?
Absolutely. You know, so, you know, like, yeah, so the Mini 2 drone just came out as this summer. It's honestly, you know, we've been looking for a kind of an entry-level drone for a long time, and we're just never happy with any options out there. This one now we feel like is real drone. You know, it's got a good camera on it. It's a 12 megapixel camera, which is pretty good. It's got great flight time. It's easy to fly. It all comes in a kit, you know, with a good case and three batteries. And it's a great kit to start out with. You know, price on our website is $759. That's not too much of a barrier to get started.
Oh, perfect. Well, Randy, we really appreciate you taking your time. Listeners, remember, Farm for Profit will get you that extra battery if you are looking at either upgrading or jumping into this for the first time. And we may revisit this topic for a full length to, you know, learn and expand upon what drones can do. But for the time being, Randy, we really appreciate your time here, and we're going to roll into our general topic for today.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Other thing we want to thank is our partner with Outback Wraps. Outback Wraps, the hydraulic hose marker company. They design these hose markers to reduce the frustrations of what you do and have when you're hooking up your hydraulic hoses. Obviously makes them easier to identify and makes handling them a lot easier too. Outback Wraps won't fade. We talked to Dave Head, the CEO there. Specially designed to not fade, not become brittle, and certainly won't break off like the ear tags or tape or what is those zip ties that you might be using.
Yep.
Time to move into our main topic for the day. And it's one of those, at least in my experience, 1031 exchanges get talked about a lot, but I don't think it's something that's very frequently used by very many of our listeners. So this should be a really fun topic to talk about today. We have David Brown, who's the president and owner of IPE 1031. He's a graduate of the University of Iowa College of Business. We won't give him any crap today about that. And Drake University Law School prior to starting IPE 1031. He served as the state prosecutor, holds the designation for certified exchange specialist, lectures on the subject of 1031 exchanges, which is great to have him here. Is a member of the Iowa State Bar Association, Drake University Law School, University of Iowa College of Law, and Realtors Lands Institute, which is another nice connection to you, Dave. And excited to have him here as he's a contributing editor to the Iowa State Bar Association Income Tax Manual. All very timely resources of information, Dave.
Yeah, we're coming right up on tax season, and of course, farmers play a lot into taxes, Tanner. So, David Brown, welcome. Tell me a little bit about your agriculture background, and how do you tie to agriculture right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, guys, thanks for having me on. I'm grateful for the opportunity. My background is I grew up in the country. My best friends are farm kids, and my granddad and uncles farmed in southern Illinois. But beyond that, probably my most interesting connection to ag is my oldest son, Ben, who is now 13, is in his third crop year farming. And from a very young age. He's been incredibly interested in farming. I think it must run in the blood, but I didn't know much about it and found some a local farmer who was selling his equipment, and we had a discussion about teaching Ben and correspondingly me how to farm. And so for 3 years, we've started from nothing, and you know, we're in it. So I don't know if you expected to hear that, but that's my connection.
There you go. There you go. Well, I know you from Realtor Land Institute and from doing farmland deals all day long. So there are a lot of ins and outs to 1031s. And I know I've called you for advice a million times. I feel like somebody will ask a specific question. So thanks a lot for being here, and thanks for getting into it.
So I think we're going to have to do a Whitaker and a Brown. We keep saying Dave, and nobody's gonna get this. So Whitaker, why don't we start basic here? And Brown, what are the four options that our listeners have when it comes to real estate? What I know you give a presentation and you kind of start off basic. Could you start at that basic level for us?
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, obviously, in our business, we help accommodate Section 1031 exchanges, and really what that allows is somebody who's selling a farm asset to defer the tax on the sale and go into a new farm asset and continue with the investment without fear of being tax locked. So that's, you know, primarily what we do is help folks defer the tax. You know, the corresponding you know, provision for somebody who owns a house. I mean, if somebody sells a house, they can exclude up to $250,000 of gain individually, or a couple can exclude up to $500,000. This is the corollary for investment or business use properties, and ag properties being a huge part of that, considering, you know, our proximity and, you know, the breadbasket to the world. You know, at least half of our business is ag 1031 exchange transactions. But besides that, anytime somebody is looking to sell a property, you have the option to hold it if it's, you know, an outstanding property, it's strong cash flow. You know, folks will want to hold on to the property for estate planning purposes, you know, and then, you know, the other option is to simply cash out. And there are some examples where that would be appropriate with low capital gains tax rates environments. And then there's installment sale options as well. So, you know, really holding, cashing out, installment sales and 1031 exchanges, and I'd be happy to go through any of those to the extent you want to dive in further.
Well, let me start off with saying I have a lot of customers in the land world think they can avoid taxes, and I'm going to use the word avoid. They think that 1031 is that they excluded from taxes. This is tax deferred, and so if I'm clear, we're just deferring it, for kicking the can a little farther down the road. We're exchanging it into another like kind property, correct?
That is exactly right. So the benefit of Section 1031 is really the time value of having those tax dollars that would ordinarily be paid to the government. So, you know, just to give us an example, if somebody sells 80 acres and the sale price is $500,000, and let's just assume it was acquired you know, in the 80s for $100,000, that would mean that they have a $400,000 gain. And if, you know, we take a combined federal and tax rate for ease of discussion of 25%, they would be paying $100,000 of tax to the government. So Section 1031 allows the seller of that farm to buy a new property, assuming it's $500,000 or more, and they can take that $100,000 that they would ordinarily pay in tax, transfer that into the new replacement property. And you're exactly right. It's a tax deferral tool. It's not a tax avoidance tool. It's simply the government incentivizing any real property owner to reallocate, reinvest, find more appropriate or better investments for their business without being fearful of being tax locked or having to pay that $100,000. So it really drives economic activity. It puts farmers in really the best possible position that they can be in, because you're not sucking out capital and liquidity on a sale. So that's, to your point, it's really having those tax dollars at your disposal to build your investment holdings and keep capital in your operation.
So we have a bulk of our listeners being active farmers, but we also have business owners, ag-related business owners, and investors that listen to us as well. So the 1031 tool, who can use that? It's not just for farm ground, correct?
That's right. Any investment, real property, or any business use property, a real property, I should say, qualifies. So, just a quick distinction is, real estate as distinguished from personal property, a personal property being a tractor, a combine, your truck, any equipment, but any real property asset, whether it's, farm, retail, office, storage, vacation homes in limited circumstances, a business, office, any of those real property assets can be exchanged for any other real property asset. And not only that, any taxpayer, so husband, wife, individuals, LLCs, corporations, trusts, any taxpayer can take advantage of Section 1031.
So you just said not a personal property, but years ago, I remember there was a personal property tax-deferred exchange. Maybe it's called 179 deduction. Maybe that's getting too far into the weeds. Is there any personal property that can be 1031'd?
Well, before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was enacted, 1031 exchanges were allowed for both real estate and personal property. And the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changed all of that to remove exchanges for personal property, but it was replaced with immediate expensing, as you mentioned. So if somebody were to sell a combine and buy a new combine, they could use the 179 to offset the depreciation recapture.
So if you're a listener farmer and you're thinking, well, no, I can 1031 my combine, there, make sure you're talking with your tax professional, because there are ways around it is what I'm getting at, but it's not maybe through the 1031. Now, Dave, you talked about Dave Brown. You talked about the fact that it's avoided. We're kicking a can down the road as deferred. There is a way currently that you can kind of avoid it, and that's if you die. So, farmers, if you want to die, you can then get what's called stepped up basis. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So one of the And actually, the interesting part of this is it's actually less common than what people realize, but certainly somebody can take an investment in exchange for the life of the investment. And as long as they don't cash out under the current rules, heirs inherit the property of what's called a stepped up basis. So if I bought a farm for $100,000 and pass on, hopefully 50 years from now, and it's worth $500,000 in my prior example, my kids would inherit the property at a stepped up basis, which means their basis is $500,000. So they cash out and they don't pay any capital gains tax. So Section 1031 can be an estate planning tool, because that gain is deferred until the point that the heirs could cash out without paying tax. And the reason I sort of throw out this caveat is there's a misconception that this happens, routinely. And interestingly, there's been some studies that have come out that have said that 1031 is generally most commonly utilized for that time value purpose of deferring the tax, and most assets are cashed out of at some point during the life of the investment.
Really?
Yeah. So, people think, gosh, yeah, it's this estate planning tool and it's the panacea. To avoid tax, obviously, for the heirs, but it's not as common as people realize.
I swear I just read something in Wall Street Journal. They published something that said they were referring to new administration. So we have a new administration coming into the White House. And with that, that they were looking at stepped up basis, just what we're talking about here. Whereas if you pass away, the heirs will get stepped up basis and you basically bought it at the current value. And they quoted in there that in the last 5 years, there was probably $6 billion worth of tax money to be had. And now I'm hearing from you thinking that it maybe isn't used nearly as much as they allude to, but $6 billion as the new administration looks at finding ways to make tax money go, I know, I think it's on their ticket. Is that right? Or what are the new rules? I know I unpacked a lot.
Yeah, no, and so keep in mind, I mean, that applies not just to real property assets as well, but so there is I think some discussion in the new administration to eliminate the stepped up basis, so that is potentially on the table. You know, but you're exactly right, that is something they're looking at.
What do you think it's going to happen? What's I'm putting you on the spot here, but do you think that will it come to fruition?
Well, you know, nobody has a crystal ball, and who knows from one day to the next what will or won't happen. There are several things that are you know, in play. And you know, the Biden campaign has talked about eliminating the stepped up basis as well as potentially eliminating Section 1031 as a revenue raiser for some other programs. As a campaign platform issue, that's not necessarily an administration approach. And what I'm co-chair of our national government affairs 1031 industry group, and so we've been active for years in, you know, 1031 and educating members of Congress. And what I can tell you is that when we connect with members on both sides of the aisle, once they understand how powerful 1031 is in terms of driving economic activity providing, you know, grease for the skids of transactional activity, everybody understands that it's a powerful tool and has been that way for 100 years. Because I mean, imagine if the farmer or the landowner is selling that property and they're faced with $100,000 tax. I mean, they're in many cases not going to choose to sell, and farm brokers, I think Dave Whitaker would acknowledge, and others have estimated that if 1031 were to go away, that, you know, a huge number of transactions just wouldn't occur because people wouldn't sell, which impacts, you know, all parts of the economy related to real estate. So, you know, there's lots of 1031 is always going to be a potential pay for. Stepped up basis is a potential pay for other programs. These are all things that we have to take a look at. What I would say is that there was, depending on how the Georgia Senate runoff turns out, a divided Congress is helpful, mm-hmm. just because it becomes more challenging to enact significant changes to capital gains tax rates, individual tax rates, and then also, 1031 and stepped up basis. So having a divided Congress, I guess in one sense can be helpful, you know, for retaining low rates, and also retaining the stepped up basis. So, you know, whereas there would have been major concern with a sweep, there's potential for a more positive outcome in the sense of having or retaining lower rates, including 1031. But it's something to definitely keep an eye on.
Yeah, in our last episode with Kyle Wywood, our CPA, talking about tax planning, he kind of went down a couple of the scenarios. So listeners, you might want to go back and listen to that too. What happens if the White House goes one direction versus the Senate being another, or a total sweep? He also was letting us know that we are sitting in a position to where we might not see anything change in the near term, because it did take a little while for tax reform to happen the last time we had an election. So It definitely isn't going to drop, shouldn't drop right away, but something for us to pay attention to. Dave, what do you think? Whitaker.
I think you're right. And, you know, to David Brown's point, what I saw in real estate, Tanner, was October, we sold more farms this year, 44% more farms this year in October than we've sold in the past two Octobers. I had to ask myself why, and the only thing I can put to it was the election. David Brown, I've had people a lot more entering the market lately.
Investors
that are all taking their money out of the stock market and they're trying to come into farmland and they're saying, hey, I'm looking for 3%. I'm looking for something because they're afraid with the new administration, they're going to one, lose the 1031 rule, two, lose stepped up basis. And they want to take out of the stock market and put it into a little safer. They think stock market was good under the Trump administration and they think it might deplete under the Biden administration. So they're pulling their money out and putting it into a safer investment right. is what I'm going to say.
Matter of opinion.
Yes, correct. But so, Dave, you talked about 25%. So for our farmers that are listening here and you're thinking about selling your farm or you have to sell your farm and you bought that thing at $1,000, now you're going to sell it for $10. Remember, it's only made on the difference between the what you had in it and what you sell it for, your relinquished price and what you bought it for. Dave, you said 25%. Is that right?
You know, just, I just sort of took an average as an example. I mean, I can go through the rates briefly if that would help.
Sure. It's, there's something with, well, go for it with, the National's 15, right?
Well, that's the lower rate. Once you get to over 250,000, it kicks up to, 20%, and then it gradually goes up to 450, where you get a 3.8% net investment income tax. So the, you know, your maximum capital gains tax rate right now is 23.8%. And then, you know, Iowa and Nebraska are right around 8 to 9%, just depends on the different states. So, you know, I'd say if it's a big sale, you want to target that higher, close to a third for long-term capital gains tax rates. Another thing that's really important, especially for farmers, is with all the deductions that can be taken from equipment. And also, equipment includes hog buildings and grain bins and fence and tiles. Sometimes those can be depreciated in year one. Those are, when you sell, are taxed at ordinary income tax rates, which can be, you know, much higher than, you know, that capital gains tax rate. So it's not just, you know, when somebody's looking at a sale, you have to factor in, you know, depreciation recapture in addition to capital gains, depending on the type of, you know, property and whether it's improved or not.
And there, I thought there was one other part to that. And this is why me and Tanner say this all the time. You need to have a team of people. We say it all the time on Farm for Profit podcast. You need to have a team of people like David Brown, because it's not just an easy 15%. Isn't there also something with, I'm going to say Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act? Doesn't so much percent come out like 4.3, or I'm going off of.
Yep, that's the 3.8% income tax, right?
Gotcha. So there's you have your national or federal tax, you got your state tax, and then you have this other 3.8 investment tax. Is there so 25% is a good average for our farmers listening right now? 25% is probably where you're sitting.
Right. So I would now David Brown, let's try and circle this back down to base level for our listeners. So when we're talking about our farmers, a majority of our listeners being farmers, the stuff that's eligible, my understanding that's eligible for 1031 exchanges is farm ground, livestock buildings, grain bins, acreages. But are there other things in the farming community, farm ground-esque, that can be transferred?
Well, unfortunately, the answer isn't quite what it would seem. So, and this gets really complicated. And to your point about qualified advisors, I mean, that we say the same thing. So if somebody calls us, I mean, we're attorneys, but we don't have a law firm and we can't provide legal advice, but we can say, hey, you know, here's what we can talk to the tax advisor or attorney and say, here's something that should be considered and getting everybody on the same page. Grain bins, grain storage, livestock facilities, because they are depreciated on an accelerated basis, they can create real problems for exchange purposes.
Okay.
So if somebody goes from grain bins and a hog building into bare ground, that could create a tax consequence without people realizing it. So the answer to that question is, you know, on a technical sense, it's real property and it qualifies as being like kind of the real property, but because of the way it's treated for tax purposes, it can create a taxable event that people don't anticipate. Now, you know, if it's unimproved property or something that hasn't been, depreciated on an accelerated basis. So, you know, a farm for a farm or, you know, a shop that's been depreciated over, you know, a straight line method for other, real estate, that would work. So, but, you know, that's not a good answer. A clear answer, I understand. So you just sort of, it just depends on the type of farm assets being sold.
Right. It depends. So what about a couple of these unique thoughts that Dave and I just jotted down? So, I've got a client that has windmills on a farm. I've got a client that has a cell phone tower. One has a billboard. Well, right through Central Iowa, Whitaker was a pipeline.
Yep.
What about, so David Brown, what about items like that? Windmills, cell towers, billboards, and pipelines?
That is a great question.
All right.
So not only, it's not just like selling a farm for a farm. So partial interests in real estate can be exchanged. And this is something that can be really beneficial to your listeners. Specifically in the context of, like the emergency watershed programs where they're buying conservation easements, permanent conservation easements. A lot of the NRCS and Iowa Department of, Ag and Land Stewardship, they'll buy permanent easements to take environmentally sensitive acres out of production, which means that they'll say, okay, hey, your property is worth $5,000 an acre. If you agree to take it out of production, and give us a permanent easement that doesn't allow you to farm it anymore, we'll pay you $4,000 an acre because your earning potential is no longer there. That permanent conservation easement can be exchanged into another farm asset.
Oh, really?
Somewhere else that's maybe less environmentally sensitive or closer to home. I mean, it helps with all the nutrient reduction stuff. I mean, it's been a really powerful tool to help farmers, you know, work with that nutrient reduction. Wetland reserve permanent easements, that works. So I mentioned that first because that just really is a remarkable tool for landowners and farmers to think through. And then you're right. So and it gets into easements on cell phone towers, windmill, permanent easements. I forget what else you mentioned. There's ways to structure exchanges into and out of those types of assets.
Okay.
It takes a little planning and discussion, but that stuff can potentially be exchanged.
So, okay, perfect. Well, so Tanner, we know what we can exchange.
Yep.
Now let's learn about the process just a little bit. David Brown, normally if I was talking with a customer, you and I would say the QI, and everybody's like, what in the world are you guys talking about? So QI, listener, stands for Qualified Intermediary, and Dave is one of those QIs. And so when I advise a client, Tanner, you finance them, I sell them the farm, and I say, you're going to need to 1031 your money. I recommend them to Dave Brown, let's say. Okay. And so they go down to IP 1031. Dave, what's the meeting look like? What do they need to bring with them? A couple questions here. What does the first meeting look like, and what do they need to bring with them? Tax documents, how much they sold for, purchase agreements, or do they talk to you way before the sale?
You know, it's actually a lot easier than I think it would seem. And I'm not exaggerating. 99% of what we do is phone, fax, and email. We do these all over the country, all over the Midwest specifically, just because of our strong ag presence. But, you know, really where it begins in a perfect world is they're working with Dave Whitaker, and, you know, Dave is representing him, and Dave says, gosh, have you thought about a 1031 exchange that you should connect with, you know, IPE 1031 so you can do a little advanced planning and structuring? Because there's oftentimes situations where You know, there's ways to structure the sales with on multiple parcels or whatever to allow them to maximize the benefits of exchanges. So the sooner we can get involved in the planning process, the better, before, you know, they've entered into the agreement. You know, next, once they're entering into the agreement, you know, they, you know, we can take a look at that. All the Farmers National forms are, you know, compliant with the, you know, the 1031 exchange provisions, obviously, because of all the deep, you know, numbers of exchanges. But, you know, we'd look at the purchase agreement, and from there we would set up, documents to accommodate the transaction, which has to be done in advance of the closing. So you can't just say, gosh, I want to do an exchange and not hire the qualified intermediary and then, you know, hope that it's going to work. You have to have this all set up in advance, because if you close without the qualified intermediary, your opportunity to exchange it ends, and you're out of luck.
So that's an important step.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then what happens next? Because I know the transactions that I've financed on the purchasing side. So now you've sold the property, you've contacted the qualified intermediary, they're holding your funds. You have to identify where you're going to transfer this into. So what are the limitations or factors involving in identifying that?
So the identification periods, there's two important dates. There's a 45-day identification deadline. And that starts from the date of closing. So if I enter into an agreement to sell on December 3rd and closing is set for March 1, the identification period starts on March 1. So we have until the middle of April to pick out a new property. And then we'd have 180 days from March 1 of 2021 to wrap up the entire transaction. More commonly, you know, folks enter into the agreement on December 3rd and close 30 days later. So, you know, if we're closing on January 3rd, we'd have 45 days from January 3rd to pick out the property under certain rules. And generally, the most common rule is you can pick up to three properties to identify.
Oh.
And there's a couple other rules, but that's the main one to deal with. But yeah, there's a process that you have to, you know, go through, and that we walk people through, and that, you know, you guys as bankers and brokers can help and guide through as well.
So it's really a motivating factor. I mean, when they put this program together, they weren't any dummies. It's a motivating factor to put that capital right back into the economy and get something else purchased. We don't get to sit on that for very long.
Well, you don't. And the reason, you know, why it's 180 days and not a year is because they want to keep the sale and exchange in the same tax year. Because if you get beyond that, you get past tax return due dates. So if you sell a relinquished property, that being your sale property, on December 31st, they want you to report it on your 2020 tax return. So yeah, I mean, it's a incredible, powerful tax benefit. And so they want to make sure that people are meeting the deadlines and it's not being abused.
So, David Brown, I've had clients ask me before, they want to sell a farm and then they want to, you know, maybe it's their farthest removed farm. So I got a farmer listening that he farms one 30 miles away, and he's like, oh man, there's some ground coming up right next to our place, but I also want to build a machine shed on it. And so I've been asked before, and I think I've called you on it, cause I didn't know, can they also 1030 their money into the building cost? And is there timelines for that if they can?
They can. And this gets really, interesting. So the improvements have to be complete, before they take title to the property. So you can do what's called an improvement exchange. Where you know, if we sell for $500,000, we go buy a $100,000 piece of ground and we construct a $400,000 building. The building has to be finished and complete before they take title to the new property. And that there's a mechanism called an improvement exchange, which we structure and accommodate, and can help people plan through, but that is, out there. And the other thing I'd mention too is, I mean, with some of the bonus depreciation, that might not even necessarily be needed. So we can connect with the advisor and the exchanger to make sure that, you know, the exchange is necessary, before they dive into that process.
Interesting. That's usually what you say, Dave. Interesting. But it really is. I mean, this is a huge tool to use if used correctly. So let's think about it this way, David Brown. What are three things or the most common mistakes that are made to where this is not effective? What are some pitfalls for our listeners to avoid?
You know, that's a big question too.
I'm good at those, aren't I?
Yeah. The first thing is you got to get connected with the right people. Okay. I'd say that's in the planning and, you know, coming up with an approach, that's important. A couple things that, you know, I think people forget or don't understand is to defer all your tax. You need to buy as much or more than what you sell for. So if you sell for 500 and you buy for 500, you can defer all the tax. But if you don't, like if you bought for 400, that's fine. You just pay tax on $100,000.
On the difference. I got you.
Yeah. And I also say sometimes people don't have a clear picture of what their tax situation is. So, you know, to the question earlier, what's it look like? Well, we get a call and the first questions we ask are, what are you selling? How much are you selling for? Have you talked to your tax person about what your taxes would be? Because there's many times once we ask those three questions that we say, gosh, you don't even need to do an exchange. You need to talk to your tax person before you move forward. Uh-huh. So, you know, having that connection with your tax advisor is important. There's lots of other pitfalls and red flags that get pretty complex with, you know, dealing with related parties and all kinds of different things. But
I was just dive into that. If you're related, I know one of the things I learned early on, Tanner, is that however you sell the property is how you have to 1031 to buy the new one. Is that correct, Dave?
It is. Again, like everything, there are some caveats to it, but you know, if husband and wife own a property, husband and wife need to buy. And so we manage that process of making sure that people are it's being handled the right way and they're going into title the right way. Because there's a lot of family farms through inheritances, there are lots of properties that are owned by, you know, families as tenants in common.
I was just going to say, if you have an LLC or your tenants in common, not to look for the loophole and be that guy, but is there a period or some time for our listeners, if they own farm ground with three or four brothers and they're like, I want out, and the other brothers don't or something, can they buy the new one and then have a period and drop it? I think there's a term for that, or purchase and drop or something. Or
drop and swap. It's drop like, swap. Okay, so like I'll try to make it. You know, quick, but like a multi-member LLC. So, you know, Joe, Tom, and Dave LLC, and me and my two brothers, we own this property in an LLC. If the LLC sells the property, the LLC has to buy the new property. If Joe, Tom, and Dave, if we own it as tenants in common and not within an LLC, I can go my separate way from my brothers, and I could sell to my brothers.
Can you just make a dissolution agreement before you buy the new one?
No, you need to set up any restructuring well in advance of a sale.
So that's a flag. That's probably a red flag.
Yeah.
That's a common mistake. That's a common mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and this family ownership issue, especially with the aging landowner population, I mean, it's incredibly common. And especially in the farm world, which I know you guys see all the time.
Yeah. So you're saying family. So what about a transaction between father and son or father and daughter? Is that an issue with a 1031 exchange, or maybe grandpa to granddaughter if there's going to do a sale that way?
It can be. So if we're buying a property from a related party, that can be a prohibited transaction under some IRS rules that if I went through, you guys would hang up on me. but the important part is, buying from a related party can create some hiccups. So again, that's the situation where it's important as people are planning through these things to connect and make sure they're on the right track.
I got you. So, Dave, I'm going to go a little higher level for our big investors that are out there that maybe own lots and lots of ground, and they have thousands of acres, and or maybe it's an LLC. I've heard of this thing called a Delaware, I think it's Delaware Trust or something like that. There's a couple other ways that maybe people can move their money around. Do you have any comments on that? Or I don't know a whole lot about it, so maybe I'm just kind of...
Yeah, so absolutely. So a Delaware Statutory Trust is a different form of real property ownership that the IRS came out with a blessing and said you can own property within a Delaware Statutory Trust. So there are investment vehicles out there where, you know, a portfolio of Walgreens will be acquired by some company, and they'll sell them off to retail investors as a replacement property for 1031 exchange.
But it's all still real estate, so it counts.
It is, yeah. It's treated as real property. It's something that, you know, they can go into. So there are, you know, they're securitized replacement properties that people can go into.
So investment vehicle where farmer can sell their farmland, but then they don't own farmland anymore. They're really buying stock in some big buying group,
real
correct?
Estate buying group.
Real estate buying group.
Well, yeah. I mean, stock is not real property to real estate. So you can't go from a real estate to a stock, but there's a distinction between this Delaware Statutory Trust, which is a their units is what they're referred to.
So they own a fraction of a Walgreens store somewhere.
Somewhere in the world.
Yep.
I got
you. Exactly.
And then can utilize that vehicle to buy the 80 that comes up next door by transferring back out of that statutory trust, correct?
Well, they're controlled and they're managed. So in terms of the disposition, it's not something you go into or out of unless there's a disposition of the portfolio. So it's not really a – I mean, if somebody's looking for a liquid parking arrangement, that wouldn't be it. Well,
yeah, you can borrow against them, I think. But some of them you can. I guess I heard
right. Yeah,
Farmers
right.
First Trust or something like that.
Well, David, we are really respectful. We want to be respectful of your time. But one question we ask all of our guests, because we know you network with a substantial amount of investors and farmers, and probably a lot of successful ones at that. You know, off the top of your head, What are some things, and it doesn't have to be related to 1031s, are the most successful people that you know doing? What differentiates them from the rest?
I just sort of speak to probably how I like to view life, maybe less about others. I just think that being successful in business is really about relationships and doing things the right way and excellence. And you know, I and attention to detail. And you know, I guess the way we handle our business is the more way we can help exchangers and their advisors, the more benefit we receive in return. The more you get, the more you receive more you give, the more you receive. That I just think win-win opportunities create situations where others want you to be successful and you want them to be successful, and that's self-sustaining and just feeds on itself. And you know, I guess that to me, along with really excellence, there's just no substitute for is a recipe for success.
There you go. Well, thanks for that. As we wrap up here, I'll give a summary, but is there anything else 1031 that we haven't talked about that you'd like listeners to know? Again, most of our listeners are farmers. Anything you'd like them to know? And then give me your contact info and where people can find you and how to contact you.
Yeah. I always get on my soapbox. Just, I mean, it's my business, of course, but it's important to the bank and brokerage business as well. I mean, 1031 has been around for 100 years. It's survived tax reform, for a reason. It's powerful. I mean, it's a driver. It's the greatest, stimulator of economic growth, existing in the tax code. And you know, keep an eye on it. So it's something that all the farm associations, all the realtor associations, Farm Bureau, corn growers, soybeans, everybody has said this is something you don't touch. This has been critical to the farm real estate economy for years. So you know, keep an eye. It's critical. It's important. Iowa senators understand the importance of it. They've been supportive. But for others in other states, you know, be sure to, you know, mention it. And we're not, it's not like a danger zone right now, but, you know, we'll let folks know if there's something that needs to be addressed, but it's just powerful. So that's what I would say. And then, you know, if folks want to get in touch with us, our website is IPE1031.com. Again, IPE1031.com. We've got lots of great educational resources, including a reference guide with all the rules. We have a flyer on red flags and things that folks need to work out, look for. We have some webinars recorded online on there. If folks want to really get into the weeds and their eyeballs aren't rolling back in their head after this podcast. you know, so yeah, IPE1031.com is how folks can connect with us and, you know, we welcome the opportunity to do that.
Well, very good. Well, I'll try and keep them out of the weeds here and summarize what we talked about. So again, talking with David Brown, with president and owner of IPE 1031, talking today about 1031 tax deferred exchanges, just that. They are deferred exchanges, a way to defer your capital gain on real property from one real property to another real property. So Tanner, we talked about what could be exchanged from rental property, farms, office, rental space, warehouses, Delaware statute trust, mini storage, golf courses, etc. You know, we talked that there are some exceptions with livestock buildings and wind turbines and grain bins and pipelines and things like that, that you're definitely going to need that trusted advisor that we normally talk about. We went into what a QI is and qualified intermediary, and we kind of only breezed over that, but you definitely need a QI per the government regulations to hold that money. They're the people that hold the money while you're transferring to the next acquired property and closing on your previous property. And then examples of how they work or pitfalls, you know, red flags like don't just change the structure of your company 5 days before you do a 1031. We didn't even go into if there's a reverse, but ladies and gentlemen, there is a reverse exchange as well.
Yeah,
and you're going to need to talk with David Brown on that. And then the difference in related parties, you know, can you sell? All in all, what it comes to every time is you need to have a trusted advisor. Hence the reason we have David Brown on the phone with us today is because we try to know what we're talking about, but it's good to have every, you know, from the seed guy to the agronomist to the farm manager, whatever it is, have that trusted advisor. So
nice.
Tanner, normally when we close, we have a challenge. Did you come up with a challenge?
Yeah. And I think I'm going to go a little different path here. Back to kind of the way I look at the most successful people that I work with, is they utilize this tool, this 1031 exchange tool, to better their position. You know, a lot of people think, I bought this farm and I'm going to keep this farm forever. It's a lifestyle, it's a heritage. But think about this tool as something that could help build that family legacy. And maybe there's an 80 that's closer to home. Maybe there's 40 acres that's closer to home. Maybe there's something with a hog barn on it that produces extra revenue. Just my challenge is to get familiar with 1031 exchanges, and then think about how they might apply to your farming operation. I don't think David Brown is the type of person that's on your monthly advisory team meeting, but he and IPE 1031 is one of those things that you definitely need to be aware of as a tool to help your farm grow. So David Brown, really appreciate having you with us today. Thank you for spending some time with us. Listeners, really appreciate you tuning into the podcast. Remember to like, rate, review, and share. And something fun. We've got a really exciting episode, last Farm for Profit episode of 2020 coming up. So if you have a favorite show from 2020, drop us a line at Farm for Profit LLC on social media and send us to our Gmail. Either way, send us what your favorite is. We're looking forward to recapping what a wonderful year 2020 was. So until next time, thank you again, David Brown and David Whitaker. We'll talk to you soon.
Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long.